Hey Alexa, what's the definition of hustle?
To be aggressive, especially in business or other financial dealings.
You're listening to the H for Hustle podcast, designed to inspire future entrepreneurs to take the leap from working for someone else to pursue their passions and side hustles and turning them into full-fledged businesses. My name is Jerome Fenton. I'm a serial entrepreneur. Every week, I'll be speaking with an entrepreneur that has taken that leap. We'll be talking about the lessons they've learned and how they've turned their passions and side hustles into full-fledged businesses. H for Hustle Podcast, welcome back. Another illustrious episode up ahead. And on today's episode, we have Gershi Van, the founder and CEO of Magma Capital Fund. And we talked with Gershi about how he was able to start a hedge fund during the pandemic. Also, we talked so much about his story and how he actually got to starting a hedge fund, how he's able to get funding. We go over so much. It was such a great episode, and Gershi's such a smart guy. I could have talked to him for another 3 hours just on how insightful he was and how much he understood his business. So I'm not going to waste too much time. Let's get into this episode right now. Boom. H for Hustle Podcast, welcome back. We have another great guest. Today we have Gershi Van, the founder and CEO of Magma Capital Fund. Gershi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Gershi, if I was to meet you at a dinner, what would you say you do for a living?
Well, that's a great question. In a nutshell, we're a hedge fund. We focus on utilizing machine learning to select optimal portfolios for different days. Mm-hmm. But I think a more honest answer to that question would be, it would depend on how we interacted, because some people like a more technical answer, some people like a more simplistic answer. So case by case.
Got it. Okay. So you wouldn't get into the nuances of machine learning if the person really didn't care about that.
Not necessarily. Yeah. I mean, some people are more interested in like a leverage component, let's say real estate investors. Some people are more interested in the machine learning component. Some people are more interested in, you know, investing in indexes. So it really depends on the person.
Got it. All right. So when people hear hedge funds, they think, man, this Jerome's talking is really super well-connected. This guy must have been like a trust fund kid his whole life. Like he has much connections. Let's go back a little bit. Before you were CEO of where you are now, what were you doing for a living then?
So at heart, I'm a systems person.
Okay.
I'm drawn to macroeconomics, which kind of formed the basis of the thesis behind the strategy, because mm-hmm. I love understanding systems that kind of determine behavior. And so I spent around two and a half years as an analyst, first entirely in the healthcare sector, but first working for a company designing a system that underpinned a preventative maintenance program.
Okay.
So it's something that would be more familiar to a lot of people. And then afterwards, doing analytics for a dialysis company and kind of designing the predictive system that would allow them to make business development decisions.
Got it. So is your background more of like programming and that side of it, or is it more about like figuring out problems?
That's a good question. I mean, my background is in finance, but you know, my heart is in, I guess, entrepreneurship, figuring out problems, understanding how finance works. I guess I'm more interested in like the how things work than in the, the day-to-day, how to make it happen, that type of thing. Big picture. That's the draw for me.
So the broad scale, not the micro, not like the nuances of doing it every day, but how does it all work collectively?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the really nice things about entrepreneurship is if you enjoy the vision component, you know, if you enjoy, sketching out how something could happen, mm-hmm. and not just thinking like for the next 30 days, but thinking 6 months out, 12 months out, et cetera, which I love doing. I actually really struggle to think in the context of like a week.
Got it. So you're more like a vision caster, like really big vision. And then you're like, guys, get to work.
well, actually it's funny because sometimes it comes back to bite you, because a lot of times, you know, you need to think in the context on the time scale of a week as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess you could say that.
All right. So you're an analyst, you're doing an analyst, you work for multiple companies. Was it always in your mind that you were going to go out and start your own thing? Or was it, what was the spark that kind of drove you to that?
It's a great question. I've always loved entrepreneurship. When I was 5 or 6, I negotiated to buy my dad's shoeshine kit. And then I used to go around and, you know, shine people's, polish people's shoes for like $5 a shot. And then, you know, when I got a little bit older, I set up car washes to, you know, raise money. And then, and kind of, I guess what was cool for me through all of those was there was always this purchase that was necessary to get the business up and running. So like in the case of the shoeshine kit, my dad wouldn't sell it to me for free. So he wouldn't give it to me. So he was like, no, you have to sell it for $20. And then I had to go around and raise that $20, which doesn't sound so difficult, but if you're like 7.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot. Yeah.
So then, you know, I went around in my synagogue and I negotiated to have people front the money and then I would give them, you know, a shoe shine in exchange for that money.
Got it. So you were pre-selling shoe shines before you even had the kit.
Exactly. and so that kind of like negotiation, I loved that. I found it really compelling.
Got it.
And then kind of that coupled with, you know, desire to understand systems and, you know, an appreciation of analytics. At the beginning of 2019, I started researching, you know, creating my own fund and kind of designing something that could do well in different market environments.
Got it.
And that kind of got me thinking, okay, well, you know, what's the pulse of the market? And like, what is the thing that tells you how market participants are feeling? And that drew me towards volatility, which is essentially just an expression of how market participants are feeling about the market on a day-to-day basis.
Got it.
And then I started slicing the market down into different segments and optimizing the allocations for each of those segments. And so I started working on that at the beginning of 2019, and then I finished at the beginning of 2020. So that became my hobby after I got home. You know,
put the kids to sleep, and then just started working on that. So you know, when people hear hedge funds, to start a hedge fund, most people think it's like, you know, $100,000, $100 million to actually start up, right? You need to get a really big check. How did you go about raising funds? You know, you hear about your past, you know, negotiating your shoe shines. How did you go and raise funds for this? Because, you know, you didn't seem like you're an analyst making, you know, a ton of money. You were making decent money, but obviously you weren't making that type of money, throw that in your investment. So how did you go about raising the money?
Yeah, I think I once met with someone and he told me that the way that you raise money is not to convince someone that there's no risk, but to demonstrate that the upside is greater than the downside.
Got it. Because
there's a lot of people out there that have capital. And I like to differentiate between capital and money. Money is the thing that you use to, you know, live your life on a day-to-day basis, to go out, buy groceries, pay rent, that type of thing. Capital is kind of excess money. It's money that you want to grow for a long period of time, and then it becomes generational wealth. So, you know, everyone needs some investment opportunity. And if you can get in front of people that have capital and demonstrate this is an idea that could grow into something very big and you could earn a substantial return on your capital, then it becomes something that's really compelling for a lot of people. Now, that's not to say that you know, the first meeting that you have, someone is just going to, you know, fork over a check for.
You're like, hey, the upside is greater than the lows. They'd be like, kid, get out of here. Who knows if we're going to figure this out. So how did you go about setting that path to getting in front of those investors?
Well, so the assets that we invest in are like extremely liquid and the strategy has a very large capacity. And so what that means is that you can accept an enormous amount of money into the strategy and still run the strategy with the same results. And the reason that becomes important is because if let's just use some numbers. Let's imagine that you have $1 billion in your fund, right? And you can produce returns of 20% per year, and you're going to keep 20% of those returns. So you've produced $200 million a year in profits for your investors. And of that 200 million, you're keeping 20% of that. So now you have an entity that's throwing off $40 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now there's real money at play. And for a lot of people, I think if they're writing a check for $1 million, $3 million, and there's potential upside of X number of dollars per year, that becomes something that's compelling. So, you know, I don't come from wealth. And this has always been I approached the creation of this company as a VC type funding where you go, you're always focusing on like, okay, I'm here right now. You know, I'm at the bottom of the ladder. How do I get to the next step and the next step and the next step and the next step? So you just fund each, you know, progression.
So got it. So did you start off with your friends and family round, tried that, then go series A, series B, and then kept going from there? Or?
More friends than family. Okay. I actually have tried to not bring family into the circle because of the, you know, potential conflict that could come up. Mm-hmm. You know, your family is the one thing that you want to never rock. Yeah. And so I've tried to like always keep that separate.
Until you start making serious money, then you'll be like, why did you forget us?
No, I mean, there's ways to, you can give family equity or portions of your business so that they benefit from your rise. But you know, if they invest a substantial portion of their net worth with you and then the company doesn't work out,
You're going to have to see them at synagogue and you're going to see them at barbecues and everywhere else. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't want that tension to exist. Yeah. So, you know, primarily friends and then networking from those friends. So friends of friends.
Got it.
And then, you know, you kind of build from there. The hedge fund model is not typically pursued by VCs.
Yeah.
Because there's a double layer of fees. I personally think that there, it should be pursued by VCs, but
That's what was kind of shocking to me because I saw you on Crunchbase and I was like, what's going on there? That's usually never, you know, you never see like finance companies in that space unless it's like fintech or something like that, which you guys have like an AI side, which I understand you can kind of blur the lines a bit, but I never usually see that there.
Yeah, I think there's a few things. You know, I think a lot of VCs want to invest where there's a clear path to exit.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have a 7 to 10 year timeline and you want to exit. You know, and sell out at 10x of your initial investment. And the easiest way to do that is when there's liquidity introduced by like an IPO.
Yeah.
But hedge funds don't typically go through an IPO process. And so structuring something where someone could cash out is a little bit difficult. So the investors that I've brought on so far are long-term investors. You know, they want to hold the equity that they've been given pretty much in perpetuity.
Got it. Okay. So you get your funding now. How much did you guys get funding to start off?
$1.5 million.
$1.5 million. Okay. That's reasonable. And now you're starting, you know, 2020 hits and boom, the world starts shutting down. Right. So how'd you manage that during that time?
I think as an entrepreneur, you have to be like a perennial optimist.
Yeah.
You have to always see the silver lining. And so for me, you know, the way I approached it was there's two possibilities. Either the world could fall apart, you know, civil society can collapse, in which case, whatever, we're all screwed. So
whatever.
No, I mean, seriously, like you can't really plan for that because if society collapses, then that's it. It's all over. Or on the flip side, we'll figure it out. We'll get through it. It'll be rough, but you know, we'll get to the other side. And right now I have capital and there's a lot of people that have been laid off. And so I can find some really brilliant people, convince them to, you know, come on board and start building the company. And so I chose the latter. And obviously you're always like, you know, you're always kind of walking this tightrope because you want to be sensitive to the fact that lots of people are losing capital, you know, and their businesses are going under.
Yeah.
But meanwhile,
there's an advantage for you to take over. Yeah.
Yeah. But you want to be cognizant of like, okay, I still have a responsibility to build this company and I have a responsibility to get it off the ground and turn it into a profitable entity.
But I mean, that's great thinking and, you know, being an optimist and also looking for the opportunities in there. But you're also now, granted, you probably already paid for an office space. You're ready to start hiring. How do you then turn that from, we can't leave our house? How do you then operate your business and start operating the business?
Well, I mean, I think the nice thing about like modern business in the information age is you don't really need to leave your house.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're dealing with, I mean, in finance, if you're building a machine learning model, you're trading in cyberspace, you know, you're basically executing your trades in some warehouse in New Jersey,
from your
bedroom, everything is automated. There's definitely a component of, I think there's a trust that's generated when you meet with someone face to face and you can see their body language. And that trust is essential in when people allocate capital. And so the process of raising capital is much more difficult. But you know, as the vaccines, you know, came out and people got vaccinated and people became more comfortable meeting in person, it got a lot easier to start raising capital.
Got it. So how have you been able to differentiate yourself, right? You're in Chicago, there's a ton of other hedge funds, like you're a little guy on a big block, right? New York, same thing. What are certain things that you guys have been doing to differentiate yourself from the marketplace?
So we like to say that there are three value propositions that we bring to the table. We're systematic, we're liquid, and we're uncorrelated. And so to run through all three of those, systematic meaning that there's no human bias that goes into any investment decision.
Because it's all machine learning. All machines.
It's all machine learning. And you need humans because, well, it's pretty important to have humans, but also, I mean, you know, humans drive research. They can recognize where the machine learning model might be making, you know, an error, because humans have this ability to like look more broadly and get a sense of what's going on and what errors the machine learning model might be making. But they drive that knowledge into the research cycle to make sure that their hunch or, you know, the idea that they're testing is mathematically and statistically significant. So that's the systematic component. Liquid, meaning you can, the assets that we trade are easily able to, you know, we are easily able to get in and out of them. And the reason that's important is because you might, you know, you might find a phenomenal investment in art or in real estate, but if it turns out that you need to access that capital, well, now you can't access it because it's not a liquid asset. Whereas our investments are. And then uncorrelated, I think this is becoming more and more important. You know, you want to make an investment in something that does not necessarily fall when the market falls. And so designing a product that, you know, could rise when the market rises and could also rise when the market falls is a really compelling offer. And there's also one more thing that's really important to keep in mind. The finance industry has the opposite problem of most industries. Most industries are trying to, they have too much product and not enough sale. The finance industry has too much sale and not enough product.
Got it.
Because there's so much, I mean, if you think about it, like every year, a certain percentage of global production, I don't know what the total number of global GDP is. It's probably something like $100 trillion. But every year, a certain portion of that is saved, right? And then that becomes capital that's in the system.
Okay.
Well, now, all that capital needs to find product, financial products to sit in and to grow. So
there's not a lot of like innovation happening on that side.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get something like that off the ground. You know, you have to, and a lot of people have done it, but like it requires like a very broad skill set, and it requires you to like really immerse yourself in the knowledge set and like be able to, you know, hustle and be an entrepreneur and then also manage a team and all of that. And to get that off the ground and to attract capital is difficult. So I think you have this opposite problem where there's too much capital and not enough product.
Got it. So is that why you started like the Total Return Fund, Obsidian, and the other one's escaping me?
Estes.
Is that why you started different, I guess, products to kind of, I'm trying to like put it all together so that can find places for the money to go.
So I think, you know, there's this interesting challenge that a hedge fund is in where it's a very, very scalable product in the sense that like the cost to manage $1 million is basically the exact same as the cost to manage $250 million. That's like a staggering fact.
Really?
So,
in other words, I had no idea.
it's kind of similar to software in that sense. You know, but it's a little bit better. Like with software, typically, once you develop the product, people can go. I mean, this is why Microsoft became so successful. Yeah. Once you have the core software, and especially now where you don't actually need like a CD-ROM.
It's at scale. You could just go crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, it scales exponentially. But what's even better than software about the hedge fund model is that you don't even need more salespeople. With a typical software product, you need like a customer support team and all of that.
A back end, people to update it, to continue to keep on improving the product.
Exactly. Whereas with a hedge fund product, some individual, like a single fund, can make an investment of $250 million because they're aggregating all the capital and your cost does not rise at all. The challenge is that I think this is true in like broader society as well. People want to allocate to winners. So like, if you think about like the most successful athletes, the most successful athletes will get most of the earnings because people are most interested in associating themselves with success. And,
yeah.
and that's true in general and in finance as well. And so what you, the challenge that you run into is, although you can run an enormous amount of money, people aren't necessarily going to be willing to allocate to you.
And until you have a proven track record of winning.
Yeah. So there's this, like, there's this, you know, curve that you need to, move forward from. And so we call that going from like subscale to scale. So basically, like, you know, your first thing that you need to crack is 1 million. You need to get past 1 million. And that's more difficult than you would think it is. Like,
yeah, it's usually like the hardest thing to do is get the smallest amount of money. And once you get past that, it's like everyone else is like, oh, you got 1 million? All right, proof of concept has already been proven. Now it's time to grow from there.
Yeah. And well, it also gets easier because your first checks are going to be like $25,000. And then you get $50,000, $100,000, $250,000, $500,000. So you can see, like, as you continue scaling, it gets easier and easier to get to the next milestone.
Yeah.
So you have your million, your 10 million, your 25 million, and then 100 million. By 100 million, you should be close to revenue neutral, where like the cost of operations are even with your, you know, with your revenue. So the reason we pursued multiple product lines was we felt there's a few things, but if you can design products that appeal to specific market segments, then you can simultaneously capture multiple market segments. So for example, like Obsidian is a higher volatility product, a higher return product. So it's geared towards like more of a classic institutional investor or family office, that type of thing.
Got it.
Estes is geared towards a much lower volatility product and something that, you know, someone who wants to earn a steady return and, you know, historically would have invested in bonds, but now needs, you know, now bonds don't have any return.
Got it. So someone more who's looking for more of a stable growth over a long period of time.
Yes.
Got it.
And then Obsidian was more of a, okay, the professional athlete market is like vastly underserved. Let's create a financial product geared towards them. And what we wanted to do was financial products, I think for a lot of people are like, what is this? I don't understand this at all.
It's not like a CPG company where you can feel it or touch it. It's like, even if with software, you can say, I downloaded something. It's like a financial product. What does that mean?
That's a really good point. Like consumer packaged goods, it's a tangible product. If it's a Snicker bar, you can eat it. That's it.
Real estate, you could feel, you could see.
Yeah. And a software product, you can interface with.
Yeah.
So it's tangible in like a different sense. But financial products are like very, they're completely intangible and they're very cerebral. They're not something that you can easily connect with unless it's your life, you know, and you love it. And
most professional athletes love the thing that they're doing, not financially.
Yes. Because I mean, the way that the modern economy is built, everybody should do what they're really good at and they should focus on that. And then you should delegate the other things to professionals. Like obviously, if you have some surgical issue, you know, some issue that requires surgery, you can go to a doctor and so on and so forth across all different divisions of labor. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to make products that had their own mood, their own aesthetic, their own like kind of like tenor that you could connect to. So like Magma, let's say if you look at the way that Magma's colors are used, they're all to connote movement through different stages of volatility.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the movement is like upwards to connote growth. And then let's say Obsidian is the
stone.
Yes, exactly. So Obsidian is like crystallized magma.
Yeah.
And so inside of Obsidian, you can see like movement, but it's solid. So
it's like frozen movement, but it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what Obsidian is. And then Estes is like the Latin root of estuary. And an estuary is just an area where, you know, seawater comes into and meets freshwater and you have this whole ecosystem. And so the goal was to create much softer tones and an area where someone could feel comfortable with the growth
Wow.
and where it would be a lot softer.
You put a lot of thought into the naming of that. Now that you said that, I'm like, that makes so much sense. I didn't really think of the names because I know obsidian is a stone and I really love the stone and it's really, really pretty, but I didn't really think of all the, that's such a, like you said, a cerebral way of looking at the whole thing.
Yeah, so it's an easy way to kind of like, we recognize that the average person is not going to dive into the product and look at like the source code of the machine learning, you know? So, but if you have these market segments that are, you know, kind of covered within certain brands, then you can launch multiple products within those brands geared towards that market segment. So like Estes could have four funds geared towards that specific market segment. This thing could be true of Obsidian and Magma. And then the really cool thing is that the cost of launching your first product, like Magma, which was our first product, is around 8 times the cost of launching your second product.
Wow. Because you're going through so much layers at the beginning, but the second one, it's like you're bypassing a lot of that.
Well, that is definitely true. And then also you can use the existing resources.
Same team, same everything.
Exactly. So if you have a marketing team, that marketing team could help develop this product as well. If you have a group of people who specialize in machine learning, well, they can help develop a machine learning product that works for other, you know, funds as well. And so your cost base goes up by like around an eighth. And so you kind of get the best of both worlds and they're equally profitable.
Yeah.
So now your probability of success rises because you're hitting multiple market segments. And then your cost per dollar of capital that comes in just collapses.
Got it. That's super awesome. I could go in a lot deeper with you, but for the sake of audience and time, I want to definitely get to some of the questions I ask pretty much everybody. Sure. But I love the amount of thought that was put into that. This is one of my questions I like to ask. What was your first crucial hire? Like the one hire that you were like, man, this person turned the corner for me and really helped the business a tremendous in a huge way.
Oh, Katie, for sure.
And who's she?
So Katie was our first hire. She came on as marketing person. She was one of the initial people working at Industrious, which Industrious is like an upscale WeWork.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And they really beautiful spaces, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've done like a really, so I had rented an office at Industrious and I remember thinking like, this is unreal. Like they have convinced me that an office space, which is just a commodity. I mean, there's office space all over you.
Yeah.
Like all around you is like a Ritz-Carlton. And now I'm paying many multiples of what the cost is.
Yeah. Could have went to a Regis for this same space.
Exactly. But it's so cool because basically they have made it so comfortable that you're happy to pay that money.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I need to hire some of the people from this company so that I can introduce that to the product that I'm trying to build.
Got it.
And so Katie was one of the first people there and she had been let go during COVID. And I was like, okay,
Gotta hire her.
I ended up hiring a bunch of people from there, but Katie was one of the first. And she ended up like, you know, she went from doing marketing to doing HR to, and then now she's our COO and CMO. And we have her thought process really like balances my thought process. So in most like iterative and like ideative sessions, it works really well.
Got it. Because you can cast vision and then she can say, all right, let's take it down to the macro and make it happen. And this is what it looks like.
Yeah. So she's really good. I'll be like, okay, like this, we have to pursue the professional athlete space. You know, this, it's an underserved market. It makes a ton of sense, but I'm kind of stuck in that like 30,000 foot view. She's the one that can actually like make it happen and like, you know, really turn the dream into a reality.
So you're 30,000 feet. She's on the ground and she'll build it all the way back up to you. And you're like, that's what I was saying the whole time.
Exactly.
That's awesome. That's an awesome hire. You know, everyone doesn't think about that. And I like to ask every entrepreneur that question. Also, there's someone who's listening to this right now. They're driving. They're at work. They're miserable behind that desk that they're at, right? They're dying a slow death. What advice would you give that person to help them make the transition into becoming an entrepreneur?
Really good question. I think that the beauty of entrepreneurship is that you are the master of your own destiny. And the anything that you see in the world that you want to change, you can. When you work for someone, you're limited in what you can do. Let's say someone is frustrated about, you know, how maternity leave should be more generous and should be more widely given. There's nothing you could do about that if you're an employee. If you're an employer, you can actively participate in changing that reality. And I think it really, like, people need to ask themselves, are you comfortable being in that position of stress? And don't get me wrong, there's like an enormous amount of joy that comes from it as well. But ultimately, like, the buck stops by you. And you have to be comfortable with that and with not, I think being an entrepreneur requires you to wear a ton of different hats.
Yeah.
And you have to find that, like, thrilling.
Yeah.
But if you do have those skills, it's amazing. It's so much fun.
Some of those hats you might not like, but you still got to put them on. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think, like, what you do is anything that you need to, like, really clearly identify what you're good at and what you're not good at. And you start just, like, shoveling all the stuff that you're not good at towards other people who are really good at that. Like, I'm not a great project manager at all.
Yeah.
I'm, like, great at coming up with ideas and, you know, solutions and that type of thing. And never being blocked by a wall and always finding some path around it. But when it comes to, like, implementation of the idea, that's other people on the team.
Got it.
So, cool. Yeah.
So when did you identify that within yourself? Because that also takes a certain level of skill, right? Most people, when they start out, they're like, I want to do it all. It's me, right? Like, when did you identify, like, I'm not that guy?
I don't know. I think it was my first job. I don't like fires. Like, I think a lot of companies are run where there are always fires. Yeah,
they're just running from one thing to the other all day long.
Yeah. And it's like a bop it game. Like, bam, 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 bam. And it never ends because there's no system put in place to, like, change the reality. And that, like, absolutely drove me crazy. And then my next job was more structural. And so I didn't have to worry about that. I was like, oh, this is amazing.
Got it.
And then when I started the company, I was like, well, let me build a company where that will never happen.
Got it. Because it doesn't suit you well as a person and your personality trait.
I think it's also, it certainly doesn't suit me well. I like to think also that it doesn't suit companies well, because I think as an entrepreneur, as, like, a CEO, your job is to, like, drive things forward. That, like, here's where we're headed and let's move in that direction. And I think when you're constantly focused on putting out fires, you get really lost in, like, the here and now.
Yeah. And also the vision casting.
Yeah. And you're not necessarily, like, moving towards that goal.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people in a lot of large businesses work within that fire. You know, after a while, it's just like fires. And then the growth line gets smaller and smaller. That's just because, you know, the Chinese proverb or Asian proverb, I don't remember which one, maybe Japanese, says the fish rots from the head down, right? So, yeah, so if the head is not doing well, then, you know, that's how it all works. So I always tell people that when I coach them, like, hey, everything starts with you and everything ends with you. So anything that you don't like, you created it at some point or another.
Yeah, that's a great line.
Yeah. So this is the last question I ask everybody that is on the show. The show is called the H for Hustle Podcast. What does hustle mean to you?
I think it's the act of, like, never seeing a dead end. Mm. But there's always some way around it. And that might be through, like, I know this guy who knows this guy who knows this person, et cetera. And so I'm going to execute this plan to get towards that. Because I don't think there ever really is a wall. Like, there's never a wall that should end some company. There's always some way to, like, push past it through innovating, through, you know, coming up with a different roadmap, et cetera. So I actually like to use the word hustle a lot because I think it's, like, really, really important for an entrepreneur to have that mindset to, like, always be moving and always be coming up with solutions to problems.
Yeah. I like to tell people hustle for me is like what Bruce Lee says, be water. Water sees a block, water moves around the block. Exactly. Water always finds a way, you know, just always goes. So guys, that was Gershie Van, the founder CEO of Magma Capital Fund. Gershie, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
And just like that, another illustrious episode is in the can. One of my bigger takeaways from this podcast is when Gershi said, as an entrepreneur, you can see a problem in the world and you can go and fix it. And that's how I've always seen entrepreneurs, as people who go out and fix the problem. Some problems are big and it, you know, requires changing the world. Some problems are small, but you can make a difference and you could try to fix it. And he says, when you work for someone, you're limited in the amount of things you can fix because you're working on what someone else is trying to fix. And I thought that was such a great takeaway from this episode. I would love to know what your guys' thoughts are on this episode. Go to hforhustle.com, click the episode tab, click on Gershi's episode, and jump in the comments. Let me know what you guys think. hforhustle.com, click on the episode button and let me know what you think of today's episode. That's all I have for today, guys. And I'm going to leave you guys with the quote that I always leave you with from the late, great Nipsey Hussle. The quote goes, "This game will test you. Never fold. Stay 10 toes down because it's not on you. It's in you. And what's in you, they can't take away." That's it, guys. Peace. Boom.